I'm John Kroll. Today, in this special recorded No Limits, we're talking in-depth about the challenges confronting and the contributions made by Latino and Hispanic citizens in Indianapolis and Indiana. We will talk about the economic impact these citizens have on this state and country, and we will discuss the divisive debate over immigration and the effect the rhetoric has on both these citizens and this country. My guest will be Danielle Dean, the new Executive Director of the Indiana Commission on Hispanic Latino Affairs, and Carlos May, Senior Executive Policy Advisor to Indianapolis Mayor Greg Ballard. Because this is a recorded show, we won't be taking calls or questions by email, Facebook, or Twitter, but we invite you to comment on the discussion online. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. You're listening to a special pre-recorded version of No Limits, in which we're going to be talking about Hispanic and Latino affairs in Indiana and Indianapolis. We won't be taking calls, emails, or messages, questions via social media for this program, but we hope you'll enjoy listening to my guests, the new executive director of the Indiana Commission on Hispanic Latino Affairs, Danielle Dean, and Carlos May, who is the senior executive policy advisor to Indianapolis Mayor Greg Ballard. Welcome
Thank
to the program, both of you.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yes, we appreciate it.
It's good to have you here. Well, we probably want to get something out of the way at the beginning. One of the things that is interesting about this is that in addition to obviously working on some of the same issues, your brother and sister.
Indeed.
And working at... Well, you're working at, you know, the state's interest and the city's interest don't necessarily always overlap. Or so, you know, with all of that, does the fact that you're brother and sister make that easier or harder?
Constant antagonism. Really, we're both
hostile
playing.
Work environment. Yeah.
No, it actually, it's not a big deal at all. It helps that we're brother and sister, I think, so that we can have that ease of communication and knowing that what we say to each other is really brought out and meant to be an honest analysis of whatever issue we're talking about with no sort of preconceptions as to, well, I can't spill the beans, or this is might be a little secret I don't want to say. So that level of trust.
So the trust that you might have to develop otherwise over time is there from the get-go. Mm-hmm. Danielle, is that...
Absolutely. I was just going to say the truth and the honesty. I can come to him and ask him a question. I'm going to get an honest answer.
Now, is there a code the two of you have to do? I mean, if it is something, one of those places where the city and the state's interests are colliding, or there's a jurisdictional question or something like that. I mean, are there times that you have a certain code and say, okay, at one point I'm going to talk as the mayor's representative and the other, and then there's a time when you say, no, this is just brother and sister talking right now.
Pretty much. We'll either make it clear beforehand or I'll just say, you know, speaking now as this, as opposed to just, hey, your brother right now. Or if there's a bunch of people around, we'll just switch to another language. And then that way no one else will understand.
Which one of you is the oldest?
I am.
You're the oldest.
I look younger, but I am older.
Yes.
So you're both obviously passionate about these issues and about finding ways to help and serve Hispanic Latino citizens. What created that interest? Danielle, I'll start with you.
I think probably just our upbringing. We are from a multicultural family. My dad has been here. We're fifth generation Hoosiers, so we really have been here for a very long time. My mom is from Mexico, and I think we just have a unique perspective on being Americans, but also having a Hispanic background. But also the fact that my dad always pushed very heavily towards education. Education is very important. And so after growing up and going to college and going to grad school, and Carlos went to law school, you see the world through many different lenses, and you see how you can contribute and different ways you can contribute. And our roles are although they're similar, they're a little bit different in that the commission just – identifies issues within the community, and then we provide recommendations to the governor's office and to the Indiana General Assembly. So we don't create policy. That's not our objective. Whereas Carlos is more into that role. So we have definitely different roles. While they do overlap, we both, I think, have a passion for our where we come from and our culture. But we have we're both Mexican, we're American, we're born here, but we're called to serve, and I think that we do a pretty good job.
Well, I guess there are many ways you can serve, obviously, in many different capacities. In this case, spirit of my question was more toward how did you identify this as the need, you know, as the place where you could make a contribution, as opposed to, you know, I mean, you could be dealing with homelessness or veterans affairs or any number of other
Carlos
other
deals
things.
With a lot of those.
Yeah, but I guess in that case, in terms of this area, how did you arrive at conclusion that this is the area that you wanted to make your contribution?
For me, I think probably just because two of my major passions are Hispanic and Latino, you know, affairs, culture, and education. And I think this is the perfect role to combine the two and to be able to help people learn about different resources that are available to them where they might not. And I think that we have a unique ability because we do have two different cultures is to connect to two different types of people or many different types of people and not only bring them together but show them and teach them things that they might not have known. Otherwise, I think the Latino community trusts us when we walk in the door. We can speak their language. We grew up like they grew up, and so we can identify with them. So for me, it was just kind of combining those two passions into one.
We've gotten to the point, what are the challenges confronting Hispanic and Latino citizens? I'm actually trying to avoid the word community here because I know that can be kind of a flashpoint too.
Certainly.
And can deny all human beings their individuality. But what are some of the challenges that they're facing? We'll start with Indianapolis first, Carlos, and then see if they vary in other parts of the state.
There are the general issues that confront this community, this group of people, that I think are standard throughout the United States, not just Indianapolis.
Absolutely.
And then, of course, there are some specific nuances that do apply to Indianapolis. So let's just start with kind of the general. Mm-hmm. Education, you know, they want access to education like anybody else, to good neighborhoods, low crime, you know, those are kind of the standard ones. Now, when you get into the more nuanced areas, Indianapolis and Indiana in general is not let me rephrase that. It has not up until today, i.e. the past year or two, mm-hmm. it has not been a primary point of entry for Hispanic Latino individuals. Mm-hmm. You know, we are really a second or a third tier destination. So the first point obviously is whenever they get to the, you know, let's say New York, Chicago, California, New Mexico, Arizona. Those are kind of the mm-hmm. primary. Those are the first tier. Second tier would then expand from those points. So then they'd go into Nevada, kind of the Midwestern states, elsewhere. East Coast and certainly the southern areas. But now we see a change. Now Indianapolis and Indiana have gotten to the point where we are a primary destination. So that means they will arrive not to Chicago first, stay there for a few years, and then determine to come here. They will come directly to Indianapolis.
What changed that?
Well, there's much more – there's a larger population. And so now uh-huh. you've got that built-in family support structure. So you know, family member X, let's say the uncle or the aunt, they came mm-hmm. to Indiana 15 years ago. They've set up a life. You know, they know what it is to be a Hoosier. Then they've got their aunt comes in and decides, well, I'd like to move to the U.S., but I don't know where to go. Of course, immediately they'll think the Californias, the New Mexicos, the Arizonas, the New Yorks. But we don't have family there, they'll say. But we do in Indiana, so let's move there. And we have seen that growth. You know, now we've got about 400,000 Hispanic Latino individuals across the state. In Marion County, Indianapolis alone, about 100,000. Even those numbers, which are kind of official census numbers, are undercounted. And that goes back to a cultural issue that a lot of these folks are distrustful of government.
Mm-hmm.
Not because they're necessarily here without documentation or because they are here completely legally, but they come from countries wherein the police force and the government
yeah,
in general.
It's not a friendly face. It's
yeah,
not Officer it's, Joe.
It's, exactly. Mm-hmm. It's not yeah. at all like that. And so they're very weary of getting involved in government at yeah. all. So a lot of these numbers are going to be undercounted. In my opinion, informally, there's no scientific basis of this, I'm thinking about 20%. Because when I go talk to individuals out in the community in Annapolis and I'll ask them, did you fill out the census? Oh, no, we didn't do that.
Uh-huh.
Well, why not? They were just, well, because it's government. We don't know. Now, so just based on those conversations, I come up with about 20%.
So that we're undercounted by 20%?
Correct.
Or it's 20% of the city's population?
No. They're undercounted by about 20%. So when we say there's 100,000 here, probably 120,000 here instead of just 100,000.
How rapidly is that growing?
We are at that cusp now where it's going to be exponential growth due to birth rates, due to more immigration rates, and then just due to family moving from other states into Indianapolis. That's why I said we're now statewide and citywide. We're looking to become, if we haven't already, that first destination location.
And if you are just joining us, we're having a special recorded conversation about Hispanic and Latino affairs in Indiana and Indianapolis. We won't be taking calls, email messages, or you can't connect with us via Facebook or Twitter for this one. We're talking with Carlos May and Danielle Dean. Danielle, is the picture similar for the entire state? Are we seeing that kind of growth for the state overall, or is Indianapolis really the focal point?
I think Indianapolis, while it is a focal point, the counties in the northwest region are also growing very quickly. I'm just now starting to learn, third weekend on the job, so I'm just now starting to learn definitely about all of these different issues. But I think that Carlos is right in terms of family. Once one person's here, and I've heard this countless times from my own board members, you know, my aunt was here, so I came here, and 20 years later, they're still here. So it really is, like you said, a destination rather than, you know, they just kind of find their way or make their way to Indiana. But definitely in the areas where there's more agricultural work, that kind of labor, and then
manufacturing.
Well. What is it about Indianapolis or Indiana that is attractive to Hispanic or Latino?
A few different things. One is just kind of the pace of life. You know, we're not a New York. We're not an L.A. I personally love that about Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. That is more attuned to where they come from. Now, there are certain exceptions. You know, folks from Mexico City, the capital, they'll mm-hmm. come here and say, well, this is a rather sleepy town. When you move from a city of 20 million to a city of 1 million, certainly yeah. you're going to come up with that impression. But also it's the quality of life, you know, low taxes, good business climate for them to start their businesses. But also it's a very family – I mean, we hear the term Hoosier hospitality. Mm-hmm. And so they like that engagement. They like the fact that they can be comfortable here. But Indianapolis is certainly different than a lot of other areas of Indiana that are going to be a lot more rural, a lot more multi-generational in terms of the habitants of that location. So – they will view outsiders in a little different scope than here in Indianapolis would, just, you know, due to the nature of the beast, if you will.
Could we get some idea of what kind of economic impact we're talking about here, you know, in terms
oh, yeah.
of where Carlos is?
I mean, Indianapolis is going to be a subset. Let me give you some
okay.
larger numbers.
Okay.
And then you can figure about 85% of that is – 75 to 85% of that is here in Indianapolis. If you're looking at total economic impact, it's in the billions of dollars. If you want more specifics, looking at sales taxes alone in the state of Indiana with the Mexican community alone, so that's about 85% of the total Hispanic-Latino makeup is Mexican mm-hmm. nationality. They show up here, you're looking at about $330 million in sales tax alone. When you extrapolate that out into the entire community, you're looking probably close to $400 million just in sales taxes. That's not counting property taxes, local option income taxes, et cetera, you know, the whole gamut of taxes. So $400 million is legitimate. That's just in sales taxes. Any company around the nation, let alone here in Indiana, would want a piece of that pie. When you're looking at total economic impact, it's $1.7 to $2 billion, thereabouts. Danielle might have the figures more solid in terms of statewide. Indianapolis, though, is one of the biggest communities in Indiana, if not the biggest, that has a percentage of small business owners who are Hispanic or Latino.
What is accounting for that, Danielle? Do you know why we lead? It sounds like we lead the nation in terms of Hispanic or Latino small business owners. What have we done that other places haven't?
I think to echo what Carlos says is a sense of community. I think that it's not something that we're doing different. It's just our overall culture and why people are attracted to the state. We see a lot of Mexican and Latinos in general coming and buying their first house here and starting their own business here. And I think just the overall business climate for Indianapolis is healthy, and people realize that.
Also, although I want to add to that real quick, is both the governor and the mayor have done a good job of increasing the amount of contracts that go to minority-owned firms. So that's women, minority, veteran-owned firms. And a lot of these folks will sign up. I can give you examples after the break is over. But a lot of these folks sign up. Specifically, they come here because they know that they will have an almost immediate access to good, stable income.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with the new executive director of the Indiana Commission on Hispanic and Latino Affairs, Danielle Dean, and Carlos May, who is the senior executive policy advisor to Indianapolis Mayor Greg Ballard. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about Hispanic Latino affairs in Indiana and Indianapolis. My guests are the new executive director of the Indiana Commission on Hispanic Latino Affairs, Danielle Dean, Carlos May, who is the senior executive policy advisor to Indianapolis Mayor Greg Ballard. They are brother and sister. This is a recorded show, so we're not taking calls, emails. You can't reach out to us on social media for this, but we hope you're enjoying the conversation. Before we went to the break, we were really talking about the impact of what Hispanic and Latino citizens bring to the city and the state. And we interrupted you in mid-story there, Carlos.
Yeah, I wanted to highlight two specific examples of some of the policies that have been put into place by both the city and the state that have allowed and really been the reason for this dynamic growth in small business entrepreneurship from this community. I'm not going to give you the names of these guys because they obviously don't know I'm talking about them, but I'll illustrate the point nonetheless. There was one gentleman who was basically kind of a drywall / electrician. He'd started up his own small business. It was him and his dad, and that was it, you know. And they had decent income. But then they realized that both the city and the state had this minority women and veteran business development program wherein you could sign up, be certified by both the city and the state separately or, you know, jointly, and then have access to some contracts coming up depending on whatever that might have been. So the JW Marriott was being built, and this guy comes into my office. He says, hey, you know, I hear that I can register to become a certified minority business owner. And I said, yeah, I'm happy to help you out. You know, I'm not the guy that does it, but let me put you in contact with my counterpart here in the city that does this specific role. So he signs up. He didn't really realize what value he could get. He had just heard that this is something you could do. And I started to really brief him on, look, this is what you are able to do once you become certified. If you're not certified, none of this applies. So that's why I think you should do it. He got certified. He came back and he says, what do I do now? I said, well, there's going to be some bids coming up for the new JW Marriott. I don't run that, but let's get you signed up to the newsletter so that you can become aware of when these are coming up. And he signed up. He was one of the subcontractors from one of the primes. He got a $1 million contract. That was way beyond what he ever dreamed he would make in you know, multiple years, let alone in just one contract. That allowed him to expand his business from 2 people to 25. Now he, his father, and the rest of his team operate throughout the state, primarily doing electrical signs for gas stations now, but also installing the pumps. And then they still do the drywall and whatnot. But he would have never been able to expand and then hire more people, pay more taxes, reinvest into the community, had he not been able to access this program. This type of program, I can't speak for other states, but I know it's not in existence everywhere. Now, the second example is a guy who owns a grocery store. He started off maybe 15, 16 years ago with a very small store on the south side of town. Again, just him and his family, 3 or 4 people. Currently, he is now the largest grocer in the Midwest. He operates out of his flagship store, which is at Pike Plaza, in what is now known as the International Marketplace, formerly known as Lafayette Square area. This man, in that one store alone, employs more than 200 people. In taxes, I think he pays something to the tune of $4 million a year just in taxes. Gross profits. This is after overhead expenses and all that stuff. He clears more than $20 million a year. This man is now branching out. He wants to now expand and become a distributor to all the other mom-and-pop grocery stores in Indiana. Again, this would have never been he would have never had access and been able to do that had it not been for the welcoming nature, for the prime locations, and for this public partner, public-private partnership that the city and the state really employ with private business owners.
Danielle, this is not the sort of story we often hear about the Hispanic Latino citizens. To some degree, and I'm trying to be careful because if there is a more volatile issue than immigration out there right now, I'm not sure what it would be.
Right.
But a lot of the argument that you hear in terms of restricting immigration, we've got people meeting buses at the border and turning them around, mm-hmm. and all of that, even buses that have children on them. Indiana seems to, for the most part, have avoided kind of the worst of that kind of acrimony, but it's still out there here. What produces that? Because it sounds like who wouldn't want to have, success stories like the ones that mm-hmm. Carlos is talking about? I mean, that is supposed to be the American dream. You come here, you have a good idea, you execute it well, you make money, your family's happy.
Exactly. Like you said, this is a tough one to tackle and not make a bunch of people angry, but still kind of answer the question. So I think that I'm trying to dance around it.
Let me take it from another angle here. Too often that, and it's the reason I've tried to avoid using the term Hispanic Latino community, because I think anytime you start looking at anyone less as an individual and mm-hmm. more as a part of a monolith, you're doing that person a disservice. But I would think, too often the brush that's used to paint all this debate is that we've got a lot of folks who are coming in here, they contribute nothing to the nation's welfare, and they just take. Clearly in the case, the examples, that's not the case. And I would think, if we're talking about $400 million just in sales tax mm-hmm. alone, they're making a vital contribution to
Absolutely.
The services that we provide in this city.
They are.
And state.
And nation, for that
and
matter.
And nation. I would think at some level in terms of the constituencies that you have to represent, how does this whole debate and the acrimony involving it affect them?
Maybe that'll allow you to distance yourself
a little bit from it. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the at times the rhetoric can be a bit hurtful. I think definitely, and it's hard not to take personally sometimes. But I think that these kinds of stories, they're not popular, and they're not. It's like the needle in the haystack that doesn't get, mm-hmm. Exposure or attention. There are a lot of these kinds of success stories, and even not to that scale, but on smaller scales, people that come and are very successful with just one store, and they contribute plenty. I have an interesting stat that's, 1 or 2 years old, but the purchasing power is $1.2 trillion, and that's not in Indiana. That is the United States. $1.2 trillion. So to say that people come and they don't contribute, it's just not accurate. But I think that a lot of people maybe, like you said, paint it with it's a kind of a one-size-fits-all brushstroke, which it definitely is not. But sometimes people have the tendency to look at things rather than objectively and look at the numbers and look at the data kind of an emotional way rather than an objective way and say, let me actually read what they're contributing. Let me look at the numbers. Let me look up the amount of businesses that have been started, or like Carlos was saying, the taxes they're putting back in. And it's just hard because I think sometimes, especially with education, we saw recently the story of a young woman from Ben Davis, I believe,
yeah.
that had mm-hmm. the 4.2 GPA and had, I'm sure she's tired of being used as the staple example, but.
Yeah, the poster child.
Exactly, yeah, the poster
child. I'm representative for my whole, you know,
right,
cultural
right,
history.
Right, and she, and by no means does she represent everybody, but it's just those those examples of people who are, you want that person to be your neighbor. You want that person to work side by side with you in the workforce. You want that, those kind, we want to keep those kinds of people. And sometimes because of the politics or the rhetoric, it's harder to keep those kinds of people here in the state.
Let me make a few comments on this. I'm going to speak generally. So if we're looking at a bell curve, if you know, if the audience can imagine that in their head, I'm not going to be discussing either extreme because there are examples of this within any set demographic within any community. But I want to talk about the mean, you know, that middle portion of the bell curve. When you hear someone say they don't contribute, that is an outright fallacy. That is an incorrect assumption, and it is not at all backed by data. Part of the problem we see, though, is the media pushes a specific narrative that is going to help them sell more ads. That's how they make money. Oftentimes, the extremes of dialogue is what helps drive people to watch, which then means, okay, we get more ad revenue, so let's stick with that. That's one component of it. The other component is oftentimes whoever is doing the talking will pick specific examples that illustrate their own side and obviously disregard the other side. I liken it to something my grandfather used to say is figures never lie, but liars figure. What that meant was that you could find me any set of data, any data points, and I can find you something to completely counteract yours. It's not what it is that you're discussing. It's the background. So let me give you some background. When it is said that they don't pay taxes, that is an outright fallacy, and here's where, in fact, we even have this narrative flipped on its head. They, in fact, do pay taxes. Even let's talk about the folks that are undocumented. The federal government might be slow and dumb, but they're not stupid. And here's what they've done. Years ago, they created what's called the Individual Taxpayer ID Number, the ITIN. What this does is enable someone to, who is here without citizenship, without a legal mechanism by which to stay in the country, so a green card or a visa, anything, however you want to discuss it, whatever terminology you want to use. At this point, generally speaking, they're all interchangeable. However, these folks can go to McDonald's. They can sign up for a job with their ITIN. Taxes are immediately withheld, but yet you cannot then get a tax refund without a Social Security number.
So if you overpay, you're out of luck.
And we all overpay. I mean, I hate having to get a refund check at the end of the year for my taxes because what that meant is I gave the federal government an interest-free loan for about a year. I would much rather write a check. Most people don't look at it like that, and that's fine, to each their own. But when you say this individual doesn't pay taxes, in fact, they do pay taxes, and they get none of it back, precisely because federal law is such that you cannot get a tax refund without a Social Security number, but you can have your taxes withheld with an ITIN. So that's the first point, just to illustrate that there is no – they don't contribute anything. Here's another one. There was a study done about 6 years ago – 5 years ago, I'm sorry, in Texas. The numbers that I'm going to give you are slightly off because it's been five years ago, but the point is valid still. Someone was smart and said, you know what? All these folks are costing us a bunch of social services and we're spending a bunch of money on them. I want to make sure that I know exactly how much. So let's commission a study. So a group of politicos commissioned a study, and this was in the northeast portion of Texas. And for those audience members, just to be aware, Texas is massive. It is the size of multiple other states. So this isn't a small geographic area. It's a very large geographic area. And they found that, sure enough, in social services, be that welfare, Medicare, Medicaid, food stamps, et cetera, the whole gamut, they were costing that region about $700 million a year. Well, of course, the people who are against these groups of people said, well, look, there you go. It's proof positive that they're costing us about $700 million a year. Someone from the other side said, well, okay, but how much are they directly contributing as well? So that even smarter person created a new analysis with a group of politicos, and they got together and they did this. In fact, the same geographical area, the same demographic, they were contributing about $1.5 billion in direct economic impact. So even though
there was $800 million
surplus. $800 million in actual – and these were folks that are not even completely legal.
Which is what gets me to the second piece of this then, because, you know, even in Texas where, you know – Rick Perry, you know, has taken a very hard line on the whole issue of, you know, ran for the Republican presidential nomination.
Absolutely.
And there is a segment of the Republican Party that you frankly – they can't take it too hard a line
mm-hmm.
on. In many ways, though, I mean, the profile that the two of you are describing of the typical Hispanic or Latino citizen is sort of a natural conservative Republican voter.
They are. That's exactly what they are.
So why then are so many Republican politicians shaking their fists at people who otherwise likely would be their constituents and supporters?
Now, this one actually hits close to home, and in this regard, I'll take off my representing the mayor hat and just give you my personal viewpoint.
Please.
So this has nothing to do with the mayor, his initiatives, policies, or background, or desires, anything like that. This is just purely me. I see it as one example of the volatile and, quite frankly, stupid nature of our federal government right now, and especially the representatives. And I mean that Congress, Senate, you know, House and Senate, I should say Congress is made up of both of those. What it is people need – it seems people need to have purity in ideology. And if you don't have that purity in ideology, then you are supposedly not of that ideology. You know, mm-hmm. a rhino, Republican in name only. I'm a diehard Republican. I won the Republican nomination for U.S. Congress. You know, I am solidly Republican, and I wouldn't switch. I disagree with a lot of the Republicans who aren't looking at this with a common sense point of view. They're looking at it as an I need to pacify my base. So here's where we get into the larger problem. First off, very few people actually go vote. Mm-hmm. Right? It's really rather pathetic that our nation prides itself on being this bastion of democracy, yet regularly we have less than 30% turnout for voting. Well, what that means is, to put it kind of on the flip side, 7 out of every 10 of us do not go vote.
Mm-hmm.
So then you're looking at just the 3 that do go vote. Primaries, even less people go vote. You have about 11 to 12% turnout rate, mm-hmm. which means that 9 out of every 10 do not go vote. So what you do is you get the most diehard of the diehards of both parties that turn out and vote in primary. When you're running for a primary nomination, it is the natural inclination of the politician running for that office to veer as far to the extremes, and I don't use this term pejoratively, the folks that go out and vote are the outliers of that bell curve. They're the most committed to voting, right? But you have to then play to that audience. They're the ones voting. When they win the primary, and then they come up on the general, and we hear this, political commentators say this all the time, how are they going to come back to the center? When speaking of both parties.
Mm-hmm.
So then they have to kind of modify, and well, now they flip-flopped. You know, well, now they lied mm-hmm. to us back then, or they're lying to us now. Part of the problem is the voter, quite frankly. The voter is uninformed, and they just don't care. And that's not my personal opinion. I mean, the facts
the
and the figures and the numbers show that. When you've got only 3 out of 10 people voting in a general election, but 7 out of those 10 are whining about what's happening, and you ask them, did you go vote? Well, no. Well, I'm sorry, you know. You are also part of the problem. I missed one vote. I've been voting my entire life. I missed one vote when I was 19, I believe, and I rather felt bad about it, you know. I still feel bad about it, but it's one of those things. It's the system, the way it currently is what is driving this conversation, and people are looking at it with emotions as opposed to intellect and common sense. Driver's licenses is one of the most readily available examples I can think of. We can come back to that.
Well, actually, what I wanted to get to, though, is clearly, I mean, there are other issues like this, but this provokes a profound mm-hmm. fear on a part of that constituency, mm-hmm. that base that Carlos is talking about. Danielle, as you know, in your work with the Civil Rights Commission, I mean, where does that fear come from?
The fear on part of
the folks who are so concerned about immigrants.
I think kind of to Carlos's point is that. Especially when it comes to the media, it's the few extremists on either side who have the loudest voice, and that tends to drive the entire conversation. And it kind of drives it towards the talking heads rather than the common sense folks who have the facts and figures to tell people, because facts and figures, they're not salacious. They don't sell newspapers. People don't really pay attention to those kinds of things. So I think it's the few and the loud that that determine what's seen, what's heard, and mm-hmm. and what's distributed to the masses.
I think that's part of human nature, though. This is cyclical. Every time there's been a huge increase in immigrants throughout history, we have seen them people fighting against it.
We are having a special pre-recorded conversation with the new executive director of the Indiana Commission on Hispanic and Latino Affairs, Danielle Dean, Carlos May, who is the senior executive policy advisor to Indianapolis Mayor Greg Ballard. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking about Hispanic and Latino affairs in Indiana and Indianapolis. My guests are the new executive director of the Indiana Commission on Hispanic and Latino Affairs, Danielle Dean, and Carlos May, who is a senior executive policy advisor to Indianapolis Mayor Greg Ballard. They also happen to be brother and sister. Mm-hmm. We've gotten a little bit of that dynamic. This is a pre-recorded conversation, so we aren't taking calls or messages, questions that way, but we hope you're enjoying the conversation. We were talking just before we went to the break about really what kind of produces the fear on the part of that diehard element mm-hmm. in American society. And I hear what you're saying about the media, although, you know, for those of us who work in the media, the fact that we're able to drive anything these days is news. And to some degree, though, it does seem, for whatever reason, you do see politicians, they're primarily Republicans, but there are some Democrats who do this too, mm-hmm. who do things like show up at the border and say they're going to strike a hard line, and they're playing to that fear. We were talking a little bit about where that fear might come from, and Carlos, you were about ready to jump in.
Part of it is just basic human nature. We fear the unknown. We fear that which we are not comfortable with, which we have not been exposed to, this, whatever this might be. And so it's that natural human tendency to be afraid, which is okay. I mean, I think that developed mm-hmm. in terms of evolution to make sure we didn't get killed early when life was nasty, brutish, and short, you know.
Hobbesian, yes.
Very Hobbesian. And I'm much more of a fan of Locke than Hobbes. Very minute in differences, but still some very key ones. However, what I was saying right before the break in terms of looking at historically how this has played out, you know, that first wave of immigrants, in fact, which is the first wave that my family came, you know, the May family moved to the U.S. before it was the U.S. in the 1690s. We came from Scotland and Germany primarily, mm-hmm. Spain kind of secondarily. But we came here. There was no such thing as immigration, right? It was just you showed up and that was it. Once you showed up, though, each one of these groups kind of tended to stick to their own. Mm-hmm. So they would show up, let's say, New York, you know, and then the five boroughs. Each one was kind of its own little mm-hmm. mini world, if you will. That fear of, well, yeah, we're in the same geographical location, but man, they're Scots and we're Irish, and so we're not going to be living together.
People still do that today, by the way.
And then let's move forward. And then you're looking at, you know, the 1800s, the expansion of the U.S., Manifest Destiny and all that stuff, the Transcontinental Railroad. It was the Chinese who we picked on. Oh, look at these dirty Chinese. You know, they're only good for two things. One is getting blown up, and two is actually working on the railroads. And they literally, I mean, people that were building the railroads, they didn't care. They just liked the dynamite off, and if someone died, well, that's all right. We got plenty more where they came from. They're right on the boats. You know, and then you move forward. Let's look at the 1900s. You're looking at World War II. What did we do to our own U.S. citizens that just happened to have Japanese ancestry? Well, we're afraid of them because we're fighting their homeland now, so we better put them, round them up and put them up into camps.
But they didn't do that, and I think we have to acknowledge to some degree the ethnic component here. I mean, I've got a German surname, and, you know, no one was taking my father or my grandfather and putting either of them
exactly
in a camp,
right,
too.
But look at that, though. The Germans and your ancestors, they had already been here for 100, 200 years. They were already considered American. Now, maybe not your specific family, but the German demographic had already – oh, they're already here. They just happen to have a German last name. The Japanese at that point, outside of really California, they were the new entrants. They were the new group coming into America. Even the U.S. citizens who had been here, that just happened, you know, the kid got put in, what's the Star Trek actor's name? He's an American. original series, George Takei. That's who I was thinking of. Yeah, he got put into one of those camps when he was a little kid. You know, he was born here, an American citizen. But it was because there was the new demographic. Move forward a few years, a few decades, and now it's the people that speak Spanish. It's the Hispanic and Latinos. All of a sudden, they're coming in full force, and that's an issue. Now, the other side to this, aside from historical, aside from human nature, we have the most crazy, complex, and quite frankly, stupid immigration system. Let me give you just a few examples. If you're Cuban and you set foot on U.S., you're free and clear. You know, why did we do that? Well, because politically we wanted to kind of stick it to Castro. You know, we, the U.S. government, don't like their communist government. So we're just whoever wants to come to the land of opportunity is okay. You go to the southern border on Mexico, and that's totally different. You know, oh, no, they're not good. Even now, though, you look at it, if you are a Mexican child or any – if you're just Mexican and you come to the U.S. without any documentation, you're immediately going to get deported back. However, if you're Central or South American – Guatemalan, Peruvian, whatnot, and you're a child, you get put here because they don't share a contiguous border with us, and this is the actual legal language that the statutes say, these immigration statutes, we are not going to directly deport you. We're actually going to let you stay here. We're going to put you into our ICE system, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement System, but then there's no backup. There's no follow-up. So they're given a piece of paper, say, show up to court in 6 months.
They're not going to
show up. Yeah, I mean, hey, we made it to the land of opportunity. You know, that's what they're thinking. Yeah. They're going to stick around. I mean, we should have an immigration system that is blanketly fair and even to all groups. Here's the third kind of component of the immigration system that I just find humorous and laughable, only because it makes a very specific exclusion to a very specific group of people. And who are these people? These are the wealthy people. So you have the investor visa. If you have $500,000 to invest and you put it into a company or you start a business or whatever, you automatically get a permanent legal resident card. So you don't even have to go through the visa application system. You just show federal government, I've got $500,000 and I will put it into a business or I will start a business equaling $500,000. They say come right on in.
So in effect, you can buy your way.
Absolutely.
Exactly. But not many people know that.
No, not many people do. But my point to illustrate these different examples of immigration rules is that it exacerbates the problem is what it does. It starts to exclude and or include. It starts to break up into groups. And so now folks are really confused. You know, now the American populace is, well, wait, why does this group get sent back and this group doesn't when they both look the same and speak the same language? Something's wrong here, by golly. You know, that's what they're thinking. And justifiably so. If we had a very set standard system of immigration, I don't know what the answer is. I'm not here to give answers. I'm just here to show what some of the problems are. This would be a much different conversation.
If you are just joining us, we are having a conversation about Hispanic and Latino affairs in Indiana with Danielle Dean, who is the new executive director of the Indiana Commission on Hispanic and Latino Affairs, Carlos May, who is the senior executive policy advisor to Indianapolis Mayor Greg Ballard. They also happen to be brother and sister. We've seen a little bit of that dynamic during the hour. Well, I'd like to talk a little bit. I mean, we've spent a lot of time here talking about kind of the for lack of a better term, the cultural resistance to some immigration. I'd like to talk a little bit also, you know, every wave, and Carlos kind of set this up beautifully by talking about the waves. Every wave of immigration we have seen in this country has left its mark, and there is a cultural legacy. I'd like to talk a little bit about the ways that this wave of immigration is likely to alter. What kind of contributions are Hispanic and Latino citizens going to make to the state other than, as Carlos would point out, the $400 million in sales tax alone? they're paying for our schools and our streets. But
they're helping.
Helping to pay for it, yeah. But so in what ways are they likely to add to the American mosaic?
I think aside from the practical economic type of contributions, I think leaving a lively cultural mark. Hispanic and Latino people are known for, rightfully so, for close-knit families, a really good tight-knit community. And I think that that only helps the Hoosier hospitality, kind of the culture that we already have. It only helps with that. And I think they just have such – they bring such a rich culture, language and food and music. Aside from the standard economic and the practical mm-hmm. kinds of contributions, I think just probably a rich, exciting, lively culture.
What marks have they left already, Carlos?
They've already left dozens. Yeah. I'm sure that every day when the listeners wake up, go to work.
The fact that salsa now outsells ketchup.
Absolutely. Salsa is the number one condiment. Tortilla yeah. chips is the number one snack. It's not pretzels anymore or anything like that. It's tortilla chips, you know. Tortillas themselves. Look at the drinks. Margaritas. Corona. I mean, look at what
we celebrate. I have a feeling people are not going to like that. From pretzels to tortilla
right?
chips, that's going to...
But that is what sells the most. I mean, let's look at some of the other stuff. The Cinco de Mayo. You know, we look at that as a holiday to drink and have margaritas and enjoy the Mexican culture. What they don't understand is that Cinco de Mayo actually commemorates a battle, the Battle of Puebla in Mexico, one of the key turning points for their country, mm-hmm. right?
That is not our Independence Day, to be clear.
No, that is not the Independence Day, you know, at all. We look at those things. They have already influenced us. Look at our soccer team. Look at the U.S. pro men's soccer team just competed in the World Cup. About half of those have some sort of Hispanic or Latino heritage in them. They're Americans, or else mm-hmm. they wouldn't have played for our national team. But look at them. So the influence is already there. It has already come to pass. The problem is not us accepting what cultural impacts they're going to give us. It's the problem is we now need to accept the people who actually gave us these cultural impacts. So they've already left the mark. The mark mm-hmm. is already there. We can go – let me – one example that folks might not even be aware of, the comedian C.K. Lewis. Mm-hmm. I've actually seen him live here at the Murat or whatever they call it now. I still call it the Murat, mm-hmm. Banker's Life or what is the
– The Murat.
Is it the Murat? No, it's Old National. Old National Theater.
Yes.
The Murat for me, for us old school people here. C.K. Lewis is actually Mexican. He was born in Mexico. He speaks Spanish, but he's got red hair and a pale complexion. Most folks wouldn't realize that. Look at Jennifer Lopez. I mean, you know, she's right there. A huge amount of artists, celebrities, chefs, all of these are from either Mexico or some Central South American nation. They are not seen at all as immigrants, even though oftentimes a lot of these folks that I'm talking about are first-generation immigrants. Why is that? Why are they treated differently than others? Maybe it's because the media, and I'm not poking on you here, John, but you know, maybe the media because –
I'm a big boy.
I know. When the media quickly accepts and backs these individuals, they are automatically seen as kind of Americans. And let me digress for one moment, then I'll let you get on to the next question. If you look at the way the U.S. Census classifies individuals – and, well, all the way up until really the 50s, 53, 54, Mexicans specifically, mm-hmm. but in general all Latin Americans, they were considered to be white, Caucasian. There was mm-hmm. really only three. There was Asian, there was white, and there was black. Those were the three distinctions on the Census Bureau. All Hispanic, Latino people were considered to be white. Now that is not the case. So what has changed? Has America as a whole changed?
Yeah.
Maybe slightly. What it has really, the change that I see there and the point I'm trying to make is that the way we have classified individuals has changed. So it's no longer looking at them like you had said earlier as individuals. We look at them as communities now. We look at them as demographics, as groups, and we say we don't like that group because of one or two who might be the bad element. So we would just rather not have any of them here as opposed to looking at them like individuals and saying – they have something quality to contribute, we should allow them to come in.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about Hispanic and Latino affairs in Indiana and Indianapolis with the new director, executive director of the Indiana Commission on Hispanic Latino Affairs, Danielle Dean, and Carlos May, who is a senior executive policy advisor to Indianapolis Mayor Greg Ballard. Carlos just said something that, you know, already these citizens have left their mark on this country. And this community here specifically, but the challenge is getting the country and the community to accept the people who are making those mm-hmm. those marks. What are some of the barriers that make that acceptance difficult? They can be cultural, they could be legal, they can be economic. Danielle, what are some of the obstacles to getting to that acceptance?
All of the above. I think language is mm-hmm. obviously a huge barrier. And the fact that we touched on this earlier is people come here and they tend to stay to themselves, stick to their own group, stick to what they know. And we talked about this the other day, is just inclusion, mm-hmm. getting everybody to an event and to talk to each other, to make friends with one another. It's hard to get people that feel like they don't have anything in common or don't think that they have anything in common to connect, to try and connect. And a lot of times people have more in common than they think. But language, certainly, inclusion, staying within their own kinds of bubble. And I think we tend to stay where we're comfortable, and mm-hmm. where people are comfortable is that's what they know. I think it's sad, but it's easy to default to staying in your comfort zone. And for a lot of Hispanics, their comfort zone is within themselves. And to a lot of, I don't want to say Americans, but, you know, other groups, it's just staying to their own group. And you don't see all of these different groups assimilating as well as they could.
We've got just a couple of minutes left, and I wanted, how much, we make the assumption, obviously, that groups have to come in and be assimilated. How many adjustments, though, does the larger culture have to make? We talk about the language barrier, which I suppose, you know, arguing exclusively for English at one point might have made a certain amount of sense when the majority of the people who lived here came from Great Britain, mm-hmm. you know, or Irish or Scotch. But that's rapidly changing now. I mean, we're sometime in our lifetimes, most likely, you know, white European people of white European ancestry are no longer going to be an outright majority. They'll be
within the next 10 years.
Yeah.
Right.
So
within the next 10 years,
do we need to make adjustments? You know, do we need to start stepping up, you know, other language instruction and all of that, Carlos?
That's a two-part question in my mind. The first part is, you know, do we need to do some sort of English only, you know, change our thought process? My opinion, my personal opinion, is that if you come to this country, you should learn English. It's the best way to get ahead. It starts to assimilate mm-hmm. your own persona into your new community. You now become part of the American fabric of life, and you become, in essence, American. Mm-hmm. So I do think that they should learn English. However, when we look at Europe, in Europe, if you don't speak more than two or three languages, yeah. you're looked at as kind of an out. Well, that would be that weird.
You're a little slow.
Yeah, that guy only speaks one language.
That's exactly
what's up with that?
Oh, he must be an American.
Exactly. We Americans should start to learn more languages, but I do think English should be our official language. It helps. It's a national identifier, and I think the folks that come here to help assimilate themselves into our culture should speak English first, but it shouldn't be a one-way
street. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing, because people think that if we say that people should speak English, it's a put down or it's something bad. There's nothing wrong with that. This is America. They should speak English. But I knew, because I know him, I knew exactly where he was going with that, in that we should be teaching our children more than one language, at least two languages, three languages.
Chinese and Spanish being the top two
right now.
That's right now.
We need to go to the side and,
absolutely.
And down south. That'll probably have to be the last word. This has been a fascinating conversation. I'd like to thank my guests, Danielle Dean, who is the new executive director of the Indiana Commission on Hispanic and Latino Affairs, and Carlos May, who works with Indianapolis Mayor Greg Ballard. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to this special recorded version of No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Cedric Freeman. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.